Hello, and welcome to this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. On this podcast, I talk all about music. I talk about my own relationship to music, specifically opera performance. I'm a soprano. And I also talk about my relationship to music research. I primarily do research on Black Americans in classical music. I use the show to document my own progression in a music PhD program at the University of Michigan. And on the show, I have guests to talk about what they do in music, everything from music performance, music production, music education, composition. Today, I'm bringing you another solo episode to talk all about my semester in review. So we're going to talk about winter 2023 at the University of Michigan. How did it go? What did I take? How did the teaching go? We're going to get into all of that. It's been a really nice semester. There's a lot that happened, a lot that went really well, and a lot to look forward to this coming summer. All right, so hello. Let's get into it. First of all, I'm so sorry. Now, why did I think that this would be a good idea to record first thing in the morning? Because my voice is still, you guys are listening and you're like, who is that? Who is that? I'm sorry. This is my voice. I'm sorry. Give me a couple minutes and I'm going to wake up. I promise. And we're going to get through it together. Thank you for listening. How have you been? Let's catch up. Let's have a little chat. Let's check in with you. How are you feeling? How is your semester going? I assume, you know, we end pretty early here at Michigan because we start the semester at a really unreasonable time. This semester we started after winter break. We started on January 4th. Yeah, moment of silence for that. It was not fun. So that means we end really, really early, really at the end of April. So I am officially done with classes. So I'm excited to talk all about it. I assume that if you are in school right now, whether you're teaching or you're a student, you are probably like mid are close to the end. I assume people have like finals in May sometimes. You're like almost there. Exciting. Good for you. How did your semester go? Or how did your season go if you're not in school? How was your winter season? Was it really eventful? Was it really boring? Lots of downtime? Not too much new happening? Or was it really exciting? Maybe for both good and bad reasons. Unusually busy. How do you feel now that we're at the start of May? You feel relaxed, pressed for time, frustrated when you think back over the last season? I hope you're enjoying your spring. Obviously, it's very rainy up here in Michigan. It's still cold. It's still Michigan. So we're cold. We're freezing up here. But it's warming up. It's warm enough to rain. So that's a good sign. Let me ask you this. How do you feel like throughout your winter season, where do you feel like you were putting most of your time and money? Do you feel satisfied by where that time and energy and money is going? Do you feel like you might want to change that up for the next kind of quarter of the year? In whatever ways that's possible for you, whatever ways you have access to. Yeah, where are you wanting to put that energy and your resources towards the spring season? I hope you get an extended moment to think about that. And I hope that you get to experience everything spring has to offer. I hope you get to enjoy some weather, even if it's rainy. And I hope you have lots of things to look forward to in the spring season and in the summer season, which is right around the corner. I think my winter went pretty well. there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot I'm really excited about. Some big successes this semester in terms of my degree progress. So let's get into it. First things first, we're going to start with my classes. Let's talk about what I took this semester, how it went. We'll talk about my finals and the term paper that I wrote, which will be posted on the website. So you can go ahead and read that and, you know, roast me in an email. Send me your feedback, please. Always welcome. So yeah, first things first is there are a couple repeat classes that I took. I took another semester of piano. So I talked about in my last, my semester in review episode, which I did in December. So I can put a link to that in the show notes. I took another semester of theory at the keyboard. So basically it is like a music theoretical class, but applied to the piano. So a lot of like reading figured bass, like, you know, reading lead sheets and realizing chords in real time, that sort of thing. Learning to think on the fly in your head about melodies, chords, and then translating that to your finger. So again, a really practical course. I'm not a pianist. It takes a really long time to practice, but I'm not going to say that I didn't need the skills. It was a helpful class. So, okay. And then I also took another semester of voice lessons with Professor Caitlin Lynch. So she's great. We have a great time together, learned a ton from her, and had a good time just continuing to connect with my voice, especially while I'm in this PhD program and while there aren't any performance like credits that are required in the program. So it's something that I continue to choose to pursue because singing is something that I choose to pursue. It's important to me that I continue to practice and that I continue to think of myself as a performing musician. Certainly that's not how everybody has to do it and how every academic wants to do it. Totally fine. But that is something that I'm really wanting to maintain at this current juncture in my academic career. So yeah, always appreciate the opportunity to just keep singing. And also our studio class is actually really helpful because, you know, it's always nice to be exposed to other people singing and their own processes for practicing and performing. And then I get to be exposed to the music that they're learning and studying. So I'm always hearing new stuff and even just hearing singers at different levels because it's another kind of grad joint undergrad class. And again, not with all voice majors. Obviously, I'm not a voice major. There are voice adjacent majors like choral conducting or something like that, where they're voice but not performance. So there's music ed people, there's performance people, so you're also hearing people not only at different levels because they're different like years in school, but also they have different goals with music. And it's really helpful to just be around people who all have a common goal of singing, but that looks really different in actuality for them. This semester, I also took a class with Dr. Castro. I took a class with Dr. Castro last year and I did an episode of the podcast. That was my first Beyonce episode that I did for Dr. Castro's class. So that was a really great class last year. And so I wanted to take another class with Dr. Castro. So this semester she taught a class on music festivals and the politics of music festivals. So it's not a topic that I was really interested in, but because I know that she's such a great educator, I was like, I'll just take whatever she does. It'll probably be pretty good. And it was. It was a really interesting class about how to build a music festival, how different music festivals have different goals, and the politics of using music in such public settings and such like liminal settings, as far as like a music festival is very different from like a standalone concert, because a festival can last multiple days and you often have to travel to it. You might stay there. So again, it's this interesting kind of third space with music at the center of it and performance at the center of it. And so it creates this kind of liminal space that you exist in for a couple days while you're experiencing a music festival. So it was actually really interesting to talk about. And then the final project was you had to plan a music festival, which was a lot of work. You're not going to find me planning an actual festival. It was a lot of work, but it was a cool final project that me and my partner worked really hard on. And I think overall, the class was really cool. It was her first time teaching it. So there was also a lot of like in real time, like, did you like that article? Or should we nix this assignment? Or how did that go? And I think for the first time teaching a class, it was really successful. And finally, the last class that I took this semester was in the African American Studies department. If you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I'm also getting a certificate in African American Studies and Diaspora Studies. So I take a lot of Black Studies courses in order to kind of supplement my research and finish my requirements for that certificate. So I took this class called Staging Blackness, and it's with Dr. Paulson Bryant in African American Studies. So I remember reading this description, and I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. I'm definitely interested in performance studies since I took that class last semester with Dr. Keira Thurman on what it means to perform gender and race and nationality. So that really got me interested in kind of the performance studies realm. And so I saw this class and it looked really interesting, kind of similar, but through the lens of theater. And so the award for class of the year definitely goes to this class. It was really, really mind-blowing, and I'm so glad that I got to take it. And again, African American Studies, they are doing it. They are doing the thing, okay? Like, everything that I've read in an African American Studies class at this university has been really, really fantastic. The syllabi are put together really well and really thoughtfully. And so in this class was mainly about stage plays, like straight plays. And so it was really helpful to kind of supplement the existing knowledge that I have about Black bodies on stage and performance, because I don't know anything about straight plays, right? I haven't read like a play since I was like in high school. So I know, you know, a fair deal about opera, a fair deal about musicals, but I don't know a lot about Black theater that doesn't have music in some capacity. And so it was really, really fun to read a bunch of Black playwrights for the first time. Got introduced to a lot of really groundbreaking work by Black playwrights that I had no idea about, that I would never have encountered in a music program. And so it just really reiterates to me that I've made the right choice in kind of pursuing another field and another certificate in conjunction with my degree, because again, I'm having a, you know, a good time in the music theory department as a whole, but obviously they are limited in what they can offer me. And that goes as far as the identities of the music theory faculty and as far as their research interests, like the research that they actually engage in. So it's been really, really eye-opening to be introduced to Black literature, meet Black professors for the first time, have Black colleagues. Like, that's huge. Have Black peers, make Black friends, huge. I'm telling you. So yeah, it was a really, really great class. What are some of the things we read? We read, okay, first of all, Don't Throw Tomatoes. I'm sorry. I had never read A Raisin in the Sun before by Lorraine Hansberry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I hear the boos. Listen, I'm also embarrassed. And I'm really, really glad that I got to read it. And I'm glad that I got to be in a room with a bunch of other smart Black people who this was their eighth time reading it. And I got to glean from their expertise and their knowledge, and like those spaces are so beneficial for me. This was actually my first all Black class ever of exclusively Black students with a Black professor ever. And it was really valuable. It really, really was. So again, just a really nice time communing with other really incredible, intelligent Black people who had expertise about this stuff. And I really liked Raisin in the Sun. I really liked Ma Rainey's Black Bottom by August Wilson. I really liked The Colored Museum by George Wolfe. Intimate Apparel by Lynn Nottage, which I learned has actually been turned into an opera with music by Ricky Ian Gordon. I love Ricky Ian Gordon. So I did a presentation on that play and then got to find some clips of some professional recordings by PBS of the opera, and it looks gorgeous. I'm trying to be in that opera. Is someone trying to put on that opera and star me? You shouldn't have. Let me know. Send me an email. So yeah, really, really great stuff. Really thought-provoking stuff. So valuable. And then my final paper in that class, I did write on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and The Colored Museum, the two plays I just mentioned. And I talked about the musical aesthetics in those plays and how they show up kind of in the structure of the plays themselves. So those are plays that have music in them, but they're not musicals, right? Obviously, a lot of plays had like music in them, have music in the background, they have soundscapes and stuff like that. But these two plays have the characters sing at some point, but they don't really count as like musicals, even though they do have the characters like burst into song. So it's really interesting. And I wanted to talk about the music that's mentioned throughout those plays. So obviously Ma Rainey, you know, very famous blues singer. So I wanted to talk about like the musical aesthetics of the blues, the musical format, what the blues signifies and represents, especially as far as Black women and their agency, their identity as actresses, like the way that blues actually worked in the early 20th century and the way that Black women were using the blues. I wanted to talk about the aesthetics of that art form and how those aesthetics actually show up in the staging, in the structure of the play, in the language of the play. There are these kind of long, like, each of the characters, each of the main characters has like a long kind of monologue moment. And so I wanted to talk about kind of the soloistic, improvisatory nature of the blues and yeah, how that actually shows up in like the fabric and the language of the play. So similarly to The Colored Museum, I also did that. I specifically talked about the aspect of rhythm and what rhythm represents throughout that play. There's kind of this reoccurring theme of the drums and what the drums represent as rebellion and as the opposite of respectability and what it means as a Black person to choose rhythm, to be in touch with an internal sense of rhythm, that sort of thing. So I don't want to be overly critical, but it is a term paper with a deadline. So we know how that goes. Like, you know, by the time you're hitting the deadline, you're like, oh, there's so much more that I wanted to do and talk about and so much more than I want to say. But I do definitely see a future for that paper as far as it being expanded into something greater, especially the section on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So yeah, I tried to really define and develop like my definition of musical aesthetics. What is a Black musical aesthetic? And develop that methodology further as far as like how I'm applying it to these productions and the staging of Black bodies on stage. So it's okay. What I hope is that if you choose to go to my blog and look through that paper, that you can see the progression of my writing since last December. Because I do think my term paper from Postonal, ooh, you know, I think we've come a long way since then. That's what I'm going to say about that. So certainly not a perfect paper, certainly room for improvement. I really, really welcome your feedback. hermusicacademy@gmail.com. Please send me an email. Please read it. I would really love to know what you think. But while it's not a perfect paper, and while parts of it are rushed, and while I can definitely take more time to think through those ideas, I do think that I can better see the progression of my writing, which, again, this year was a really big writing year for me, like really focusing on nailing down new techniques for writing, like a consistent writing process. And I do think you can see evidence of progress in this paper. So I think in that sense, I am a little proud. One other thing that I'm proud about that I'll mention really quickly is that this semester I also passed my comprehensive exams. Pause for applause. Oh, thank the Lord. Oh my God. So yes, I've passed my comps. So excited about that. Basically, how comps works at the University of Michigan and the theory program, there's a separate kind of process for musicology students. For us, for the theory comprehensive exam, basically, it's a two-part exam. Takes about 8 days in total. Yikes. What you have to do is you have a tonal exam and then you have a post-tonal exam. The tonal exam, basically, you get given like a tonal prompt. You get a short tonal piece. It could be an art song. It could be a short piano piece. It kind of depends, but it's normally not longer than maybe 2 pages. And yeah, you get given 4 days to do a big analysis of this piece. Normally, they ask you to look through the lens of like harmony, voice leading, like identify some of the key motives. So you do like a motivic analysis and then you do a phrase rhythm analysis. And then after, yeah, like 4 days, you have to do like an oral presentation of your analysis with some sort of visual representation of your analysis. You might have a PowerPoint, you might have handouts or whatever with all of your kind of notes or graphs or however you choose to represent your analysis. It doesn't have to be Shankaran analysis per se or anything like that. So you kind of get to decide visually how you want to represent your analysis. So yeah, I got Mendelssohn as my piece. I got one of the songs without words in F sharp minor. I'm actually not super familiar with Mendelssohn, so I was already nervous going into it, but I really hunkered down and did it and passed the tonal exam. After you pass the tonal, you move on to the post-tonal portion. So it's a similar thing. You get given around 4 days, something like that. And then this time you have to write a paper on some sort of post-tonal piece. And for the post-tonal, they give you some more specific prompts. I think with the tonal, it's a lot more general, just to kind of see what aspects of the tonal piece you want to talk about and you want to highlight in your analysis. So it's a bit more open-ended when they give it to you. But with the post-tonal, they'll give you some specific questions like, oh, look at this measure, or look at, you know, this phrase in section B, and how does that relate to section A? Like, they'll give you some more specific questions about your post-tonal. And then this time you don't have to do an oral presentation. This time you write like an analytical paper. So for my post-tonal, I got the George Walker cello sonata, and I had to analyze the second movement, which is the slow movement. I had heard this piece like one time before, and it's a really beautiful piece. Again, I was pretty intimidated, especially because I didn't have the greatest semester last semester when I was in a post-tonal class. So I was definitely more nervous going into the post-tonal, but I passed. Ah! So yeah, that's a huge success of this semester that I'm really excited about. So now it's time to talk about teaching. Let's give a little teaching update on how my teaching has gone. So listeners will remember from my last semester in review episode, which was in December, that my first semester of teaching went okay. It was okay. It was all right. The girls were all right. Okay. So, you know, I survived. My students did well, nothing ended up on fire. So like, for all intents and purposes, it was a success. But I'm glad to report that my second semester of teaching felt even better. I'm really pleased. I'm really pleased with how this semester went. I definitely felt a lot more confident going into it. I had a lot of the same students, which was really great. It just made me feel really nice that a lot of the students wanted to continue in the sequence with me. So that felt encouraging. And like I was just walking into more familiar territory because obviously I knew the majority of my students. I did teach an 8:30 this semester. If any of my 8:30 students are listening, bless you. It's not an easy thing to do, to wake up for an 8:30 class. It was not easy for me. It was not easy for them. But we made it through, and I honestly had great attendance in both sections. I taught an 8:30 and I taught a 10:30, both the second courses in the oral skills sequence, you know, of four classes. So everybody did, again, really well. And I felt a lot more comfortable, a lot more confident. Even though it was like new material for me to teach, obviously, because I'm progressing with them in the sequence, it was really exciting to kind of see them learning in real time, introduce, you know, most of the chords in, as we talk about, in diatonic harmony. And so, yeah, just some really bright students, some great questions. You know, when you have those students and you can see them and, you know, you're seeing them on the homework and you're seeing the way their brains work and you're like, dang, how do we get them? I'm already having those moments with some of my students where I'm like, oh my gosh, you're right there. Like, you know, the questions that they're asking are deeper than just like, you know, how do we figure out this chord? They're like, but why do we call it that? Why is this chord this way? Why is it always followed by that chord? What's going on there? And they're asking these questions and you're like, ooh. Wow. Is this what it feels like? The pride, the teacher pride of like, oh my gosh, a little future theorist. Yes, yes. So, students, you know who you are if you're listening to this. If you're listening to this, hopefully the bug has already bit you if you are listening to this podcast. LOL. So, but, you know, it was really, really fun, full of lots of really great moments for me, at least, and I hope for my students that they, even if they didn't find it interesting, that they at least didn't find it awful or inaccessible, right? Like, hopefully none of my students were like, this is not ever something that I could do, or they're developing, you know, a harmful relationship to music theory where, you know, it becomes hostile to them. So hopefully, again, you can't get them all. The goal is not to turn my students into a bunch of theorists and musicologists. The goal is for them to at least once a semester say, oh, that was kind of interesting, or, oh, that relates to this song that I'm playing or studying or singing, and I had never thought of it that way. And if I can just get my students to think about music in slightly new ways, or to develop their own ways of thinking about music, to, yes, absolutely question, why is this chord called that? Where is this all coming from? What is the historical context? Like, to just think a little bit deeper and absolutely develop independent ways of thinking about music. That's an absolute success. That's more important than knowing all of your, you know, inversions of 5/7. So I think that all things considered went really well. Now, I will say, obviously, things were affected and disrupted by the strike of 2023. Whew. So if you have not listened to the last episode, which was an episode that I did with Anna Rose Nelson all about the strike situation at the University of Michigan, yikes, 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 yikes. It's not great. We didn't talk about in that episode kind of the specific politics of what's happening in the music theory department. You'd be surprised, there's a lot happening. You would think music theory would continue to be pretty boring. It's not. It's actually been kind of, there's been a flurry of activity related to the strike and how it's been handled by the music theory department. Here's what I'm going to say, because I'm not going to say a lot about this. I would rather, if I'm going to talk about this and specifically how it relates to music theory, musicology, the music academic kind of side of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance, I'm going to need to talk about it after it's over. Because that's right. As we're recording this, I am recording this on May 2nd. The strike is still going. We're almost 5 weeks in. Isn't that crazy? It's really wild. So the negotiations are ongoing. We still have not received an offer at the bargaining table from academic HR that meets the needs of the graduate employees organization. Yeah, it's a situation. Again, I'm just going to maybe do another episode once it's over. I will give an update. But if you are interested in more strike-related content, please go back and listen to the last episode. That was a really thorough deep dive into how that situation came to be. And then just make sure you follow GEO. I believe it's at GEO3550 on Twitter and on Instagram. You know, find them on social media. You'll get all the live updates. You know, pretty soon after we know, like, what's happening. And so, yeah, unfortunately, my teaching and the teaching in the music theory department was definitely affected by the strike. Let me just not say any more about that. This is something that I can say because this is public knowledge. The university has gone ahead with taking away the wages of graduate workers for the month of April. Now, basically, because we talked about in the last episode that they have this attestation form that they began to send out to all of the grad students who teach, right? So GSIs and GSRAs, research assistants, and that you had to fill it out and attest that you were not on strike in order to get paid. And then they carried through on their threat to take away the wages of anybody who did not fill out the form, whether you were on strike or not. I know what you're thinking. You're like, is that legal? Kind of not. So we're in the process of filing a bunch of grievances right now because it's a whole mess. Not filling out a form is not adequate proof that someone is on strike, especially when it's not included in our contract that we have to do any sort of logging of hours, like any sort of cataloging when we're working and when we're not. So to suddenly require something like that in order to get paid is a big deal, and it's definitely grounds for like a bunch of grievances. So we are in the process of filing those right now. We're trying to negotiate back pay. We're trying to get everybody paid. But honestly, it's a really, really heinous thing for the university to do because grad students need to pay their rent and their expenses in May. Grad students have dependents that they have to feed and take care of in addition to themselves. So grad students cannot plan for emergencies if, you know, the little money that we make from the university is suddenly taken away without the university actually proving who is on strike and who is not. They still have yet to do that. The theory department in SMTD has still has yet to prove who is on strike and who is not. So it's just a really baffling, incredibly dangerous, heinous choice. And the university should be really ashamed. Of course, they're not, because they're an institution. They don't feel shame. They are fueled by capitalism and the reproduction of the university. So it's really frustrating. I can confirm that I got my wages taken away. Yes, me, listener. I got paid about $100 for the month of April. Yeah. So, really unfortunate. What I will say, I will put the link to the strike fund in the show notes. The strike fund has been dispersed, and fortunately, we were able to get everybody's minimum needs met. So it's not an ideal situation where everybody got their maximum requested amount, but we were able to give everybody their minimum kind of need for this first disbursement of the strike fund. Now, we still need money because we don't know how long the negotiation is going to take for the university to give us back our lost wages for April. And so, like, we do still need money. So I'm going to put the strike fund in the show notes. Please donate to the strike fund. Please share the strike fund. It's really important that we can continue to survive while we bargain at the table and while we use collective union power to really get our needs met. Again, I'm going to start getting too angry if I keep talking about this, but please follow Jiho, because again, there's just been a bunch of like escalations there. You know, President Santa Ono called the police on some picketing protesters a few weeks ago, and two picketers got arrested, even though it was not a violent situation. So it's like, oh my gosh, police are getting caught, like wages are being withheld. It's really, really frustrating. So give if you can, share the strike fund. Please make sure you stay up to date on all of the strike news by following those social media outlets. Oftentimes we have like phone zaps or email zaps where we email the provost office, we email the Board of Regents, we email Santa Ono. So if you can participate in calling, in sending emails, all that stuff in order to disrupt and to encourage them to give us a living wage, that would be great. There's like truly been so much news that has come out since the last episode that I recorded with Anna Rose. So I'm taking a deep breath. I'm not going to get into all of it. What I want to finish up with is, am I at the point? Oh my gosh. Am I a scholar? Hold on. I'm about to cite myself. That's how you know that she made it. I'm about to cite myself. So I did a lecture at the University of Kansas. This is about a year and a half ago, and it is on my website. So it's under the YouTube tab. You can watch this lecture. I gave a lecture about a book called A Third University is Possible by L.A. Paperson. And it's this really, really fantastic little book. I will try to find the link because I believe it's open access. So I think that you should be able to read it online for free. But it's a really great short book about the university system and the university in relation to land, the university in relation to indigenous peoples, the university in relation to exploitation and capitalism. And it's just like, was for me a really, really valuable introduction to decolonization studies. And so I would really, really, really recommend this book to kind of really think through the inherent exploitative, predatory nature of institutions. Because I think something that's been really fascinating to watch about the response, like the faculty response to something like this, to a strike. Obviously, we have a lot of faculty that are supportive of the graduate students getting a fair contract, but there are a lot of faculty that are watching and they're like, this has nothing to do with me. I am not about to get involved. I am not about to donate. You know, the grad students just need to get in line and bargain at the table. And, you know, the strike is not accomplishing anything except hurting undergrads. So kind of parroting what the university has been saying about GEO. And what I think is interesting about that is faculty should really contemplate their relationship to the university in that your position, even if you are a tenured faculty member, is a lot closer to a grad student in precarity than to administration. So we could think of this in terms of class politics, right? That it's really easy as somebody who might be like a middle-class person, right, to separate themselves from working-class people, from impoverished people. That'll never be me, right? Like, I don't associate with people that are impoverished because they're just so far below me. And that would be realizing that those middle-class people are so, so, so much closer to a place of total financial precarity, especially in the United States with our healthcare system. It could take like one to maybe two medical emergencies, giant accidents to you or someone in your family away from you being in absolute precarity, financial ruin, right? Like crippling debt. None of us are that far away from people that we walk by on the street. It's uncomfortable to notice them and to look at them and to acknowledge them as people, but we are much, much, much closer to that than to right billionaires. Yeah. And so faculty that want to kind of distance themselves from the situation because they're like, I mean, I did my time as a grad student. I did my suffering. And I'm here as a safe faculty member and it's just not my ministry. And it's like the university does and will exploit you any moment that it gets, any moment that it is financially viable to do so. You are not immune to being exploited. Just because you're tenured and you have job security, you are not immune to the university also flipping the script and explicitly exploiting you. And so, again, listen to my lecture to really think through, brainstorm ways that we can deal with that, the realities of that. It's a reality. Shout out to my friend Devin, who sent me some Twitter posts by Tressie McMillan Cottom. Love her, obsessed. And I just wanted to read a few things that she's kind of said about interacting with the institution of academia and what power you do have and what power you don't have and what do we do about that. So she writes on Twitter, whether the institution makes you feel great or horrible, it isn't about you. Institutions aren't choosing not to love you. They are choosing to reproduce themselves. I'm just a widget. This is really key, right? Because what she's saying here is it's not about if you're having a great time in academia, which there are people that do, right? Like, you have to examine who they are. Like, they're probably people with a lot of privilege. Yeah. But, like, even the people who are, you know, applauded by academia, right, who get all the accolades and who have all the success and who are having great experiences in academia, that's because you're the type of person that academia wants to promote. You're the type of person that makes academia look good and innocent and like a public good and service that they're providing for the public. And it's actually not about you or how smart you are or how, you know, accomplished you are and how capable you are, though you know, you're those things. You possess intelligence and perseverance. But that doesn't mean the people that don't get those accolades don't possess intelligence and perseverance. Whether academia chooses you or doesn't choose you, whether you can get a job in academia or you can't, it's actually not at all about you and all about what is most beneficial for the institution of academia. That's a humbling thought for people who are killing it in the game. Okay. It's not about you. And for the people that can't get a job and who have been rejected from academia or who are clearly being exploited, that's also not about you. It doesn't mean that you're incompetent, that you are less capable than your peers who are having better experiences than you. Cottom goes on to say, this place was fucked up when you got here. It will be fucked up when you leave here. All you can control is how much you let it fuck you up in the process. That is a pretty impolitic stance, but I stand by it. I don't think these institutions can support or love us. And I honor the many, many people who do work to make them more humane, but you alone cannot do that. And you cannot do it ever by killing yourself. You will have so many invitations to your own funeral. Folks who love you and like you and respect you will even send them. But you do not have to show up for that. If there isn't a collective movement happening, you can't stand in that gap alone. Don't let these folks kill you. After all that, I hope you spend that time when you would have been dressing for your own funeral on the parts of this messed up system that can be enjoyable. Do that. Get one skill while you're here and get out as efficiently as you can. She's the best. What? She ate it up. Damn. I will put that whole thread, these are two threads, in the show notes for y'all. That piece about collective movement is huge. Like, it's huge. Because if you don't have other people who are also working for collective change, for collective good, and when we're talking about grad students on strike, like, that stuff benefits the whole of the university, every worker at the university. It also benefits lecturers. It also benefits faculty. Dignity for the people at the bottom of the totem pole means that everybody gets to benefit from the work of that activism. And so if there isn't collective action that you can be a part of, because that's how we have the most power, is collectively as a unit, then you can't go out on a limb alone. That only ensures suffering for yourself, and then that doesn't actually lead to long-term change for others. A lot to think about, and I really hope people who are keeping tabs on the strike from other universities are really watching and taking notes, because it could be your university next. We're really seeing right now, right, this large-scale labor movement. All the people in Hollywood just went on strike. Like, it's a long-term, in Canada, it's happening. It's happening. So I just hope that people aren't living in the facade that their university won't betray them or won't take the opportunity to exploit them if it benefits them. Please be prepared to act collectively. Please be prepared to act on behalf of loyalty to the people that you work with and not the people that you work for. Okay, moving on, now that I've done my fair share of yelling. Here, see, my voice is there. I'm here. This is what I sound like. Hello. So let's talk a bit about extracurriculars and what I've been doing kind of in my spare time. Again, last semester, I really went overboard. I have hopefully learned my lesson. I got up to way less this semester, which I'm proud of. So first thing, I'm still rocking with my church gig. I really like being a church musician. I thought all the Christmas stuff, I mean, it was a lot, but it was really fun. Easter, Holy Week, it's a lot, but it's really, really fun. I love some sacred music. Call me for all of your church soprano endeavors. HerMusicAcademia@gmail.com. Let me premiere your music, please. Also, I just spent the last few weeks singing with the Motor City Lyric Opera. So we did this thing called Opera on Wheels, which was like an opera outreach program. We went to a bunch of schools, like middle schools, high schools, and some senior homes to do some singing. It was really fun. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of driving. But I'm really glad that I got to participate in it. It was really thought-provoking. So let's talk about some of those thoughts. The actual experience was really fun. So like I said, we went to a bunch of schools. We did kind of a shortened, like, opera's best hits program. So it was like 40 minutes of music, not a ton of singing, but we did do it twice a day. We did like almost 20 little mini performances. There was some magic flute in there. There was some Gilbert and Sullivan. The program was called Mozart to Les Mis. So there was a lot of Les Mis, which I love. So a good mix of like musical theater, opera, and like operetta. I might do a blog post about this because it really made me think about when I was applying to the University of Michigan and I had to do like an entrance essay. You know, you have a series of little entrance essays, papers that you have to write. I remember one of the prompts was something like, you know, give us like a challenge in music that you think about often or that you feel conflicted about in some way. And I ended up writing about my experience that I had. So I had a very similar experience to kind of this opera thing that I was doing. When I started playing music, my first instrument was viola. And that happened because I was in maybe fourth grade, something like that. I was living in Denver at the time, and the Denver Symphony Orchestra came to my elementary school, and they played. And it was such a fantastic experience. I was sitting in the audience, and I was like, I've never heard anything like this. And that was the goal, right, was to expose young kids to classical music, and they did this, you know, introduction of all the instruments, and I knew instantly, like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a musician. I don't want anything else in life. I just want to play music. And then the next year, I started playing viola, and the rest is history. So it's interesting to be kind of on the other side of that type of interaction, because this time I was the one going to schools and singing opera, and you know, we had a great, the best part was the little Q&A session afterwards where the kids got to ask questions. How did you get involved in opera? How do you sing so loud and so high? How do you make your voice sound like that? Does your voice get tired? Like, you know, great questions. And it was just so great to interact with them and afterwards even, you know, meet some of the kids by name and have, you know, extended conversations with them. I remember writing for my little Michigan essay, I think a lot about that first experience. What if that experience had not happened to me, right? Like, what if the Denver Orchestra never came to my school? And what if I hadn't had that particular experience in classical music? Would I still be a musician? Would I still be a classical musician? Maybe something would have happened a little later, something really similar. And I still would have ended up playing viola or something like that. But I think a lot about like the childhood that I had growing up in really white suburban settings split between Denver, Colorado, and Phoenix, Arizona. And often I kind of look back and I bemoan, like, I wish that I had had a more diverse upbringing. I wish that I grew up around Black people and had Black peers and Black friends. I was one of maybe 5 or 6 kids in my high school. And my high school had probably about 2,000 kids. So for context, like that's kind of the racial landscape that I was living in. And I often look back and think like, I wish that my upbringing was different and I wish that I'd grown up in a more urban setting and, you know, that I had a different understanding of my Blackness much earlier in life. I didn't start thinking about my Blackness till I was about 23. That's when I moved to Chicago, started making Black friends for the first time, and started reading Black literature for the first time, listening to Black music for the first time, and kind of made a concerted effort to understand my positionality as a Black woman in the U.S. and in classical music. So I think a lot about, and I wrote that little paper about, like, what would have happened if I hadn't had that experience when I was in fourth grade of this orchestra? And what if I hadn't, you know, discovered music in this way? It was such a positive experience for me. I would have hated for it to go a different way. But would I have hated for it to go a different way? Because I think a lot about, like, if I was in a more urban setting, in a school that maybe had more diversity and maybe had other Black students that I could interact with, but then didn't have a great music program and wasn't able to pay a professional orchestra to come and play, and then I wouldn't have been maybe exposed to classical music. I don't know, I might have ended up a different type of musician. Maybe I would have gone into jazz or something like that, a historically Black genre. So I hesitate to say that it would be worse, but it might be really different. And I kind of wrote about this experience that I had, even though it was so positive for me. It's giving gentrification, maybe. Maybe. When we're talking about having conversations about taking white art music into primarily Black schools, which is what we did through this opera program, full disclosure, right? So even though I'm Black, I participate in this white art form. Again, I do research to kind of try and show that classical music, especially in the United States, does have Black roots as far as how American musical aesthetics have developed. But, you know, we went to all these schools in like the Metro Detroit area. So all schools with a lot of Black kids. Certainly being exposed to opera, like an operatic sound for the first time. And it was really fun, and they seemed to enjoy it. I don't know, I feel weird. I feel weird. It worked on me, but like, I really want to wrestle with kind of the implications of that, because this is the art form that we're having that conversation about. We're not having conversations about, we need to take hip-hop and jazz to like white schools because they might not be exposed to it. Like, right, that's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. So, I don't know. It was, again, it was a positive experience for me, but it also wasn't about me. I wish that we had had more extended time to ask the kids what they thought of it. And certainly there were some schools that were more receptive to others, some audiences that really paid attention, and some audiences that were pretty bored or distracted. That could be an age thing, obviously. But, you know, some of the schools, they were kind of, you could tell that they were pretty confused. Like, what am I looking at? I don't really know how to feel about this. So I hope that it was a net positive. I hope that it wasn't harmful. And I do think there is something to be said about, again, being a Black kid and seeing a Black body on stage in any capacity can really expand your mind about what Blackness is and can be. And I do think that that is positive. So I think that there's value in seeing Black people engage in art forms, in expressions, in aesthetics, in fashion, in gender expressions, and expressions of sexuality that we don't associate with Blackness easily. Because those expressions of Blackness exist and they deserve to be seen. So I hope in that way that it was positive. Like, there were a lot of kids that came up to me and were like, you're my favorite, which, like, obviously. Like, I'm so glad that I got to watch you. I really loved this song or that song. That was really interesting. So, again, I hope it was positive, but I'm conflicted. So I might post that little essay that I wrote on the blog, just because it brought up a lot of old thoughts around, yeah, like, what is the nature of gentrification? What is the actual goal of taking this type of music into underfunded inner city schools? Are we trying to make a bunch of opera singers? Are we trying to make a bunch of future donors and audience members? Are we, right? Like, and of course, again, the other way around, as far as bringing Black musics to white communities, hugely different implications. So, like, what are we actually trying to do? What are we actually trying to say? What are we trying to impart to these kids? And what's the ideal outcome? I don't know that there's an easy answer to that, or every opera company would have a different answer. So, just a lot to chew on there. Stay tuned. I will post that paper on the blog, and I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback. Great, so let's check in now about how my yearly theme is going. Do y'all remember this? We talked about it in the last semester in review episode that I participate in something called a yearly theme. So instead of New Year's resolutions, I set a theme for the year that's kind of an all-encompassing thing, goal that I work towards. The goal is actually to make it less specific, so that a lot of different things can kind of fit under the umbrella of your yearly theme. This year, my theme is the year of simplicity. So I'm kind of taking the goal of ambition that I had for the last year and really trying to whittle it down to, okay, let's keep ambitious, Lydia, but let's not keep like overcommitment, Lydia, who says yes to everything without really thinking through the implications of saying yes to everything. And yeah, let's not keep run herself into the ground, Lydia, for the sake of academia, Lydia. No. So we're kind of redoing that, rethinking some things, rethinking boundaries, things like that. I am proud to report that my semester of simplicity has gone surprisingly well. So I've really been enjoying kind of taking a step back, looking at my routines, seeing what I can simplify, what I can strip down, what I can just kind of focus on the bare bones of and make sure that I do that really, really well. And that's gone a really long way for me this semester. So I'm excited to continue to take that into the summer and then into the fall semester in 2023. It's my entire year, 2023, year of simplicity. One thing that has gone really, really well for me so far is I had the goal to minimize my travel. Last semester, I spoke at 2 national conferences, which was really great, and then I had to travel for a wedding, so it means that I was gone for like almost 3 weeks of the semester. It was not fun. I was not having a good time. I was very stressed. Again, it was my first semester of teaching too, so I was kind of just leaving my students in the lurch, and they had subs and stuff like that, and I was worried about that. I was handling my own classes from afar. Did not work well for me. So I really wanted to keep my trips to a minimum this semester, and I only went on one trip. I went to Philadelphia for spring break, and I didn't go for the whole break. I only went for like 4 or 5 days. And that was really, really, really beneficial that I kind of kept it to an assigned break in the semester. So I wasn't traveling on like a weekend. I was really trying to use my weekends to prioritize rest a bit more, prioritize seeing my friends a bit more, cooking and cleaning a bit more. And my trip to Philadelphia was great. So yeah, that went really well for me, and that's something that I definitely want to keep going forward is during the school year, if I can really keep it to like 1, maybe 2 trips and really prioritize like on the weekends, Lydia needs to be asleep. I do not need to be in an airport. It's just not for me. I love all of you travel girlies that are listening. Love y'all. You know? Do it up. Do it for the both of us, to be honest, because Lydia's going to be asleep. So that is something that I've really learned about myself, and I'm glad to be prioritizing that going forward. I also want to share productivity-wise kind of a method that I've been using that I've also found really helpful in terms of simplicity. It's called the 333 method. It's by Oliver Berkman. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can read more about it, but kind of the SparkNotes version is that basically when you're planning your work day, and I sometimes also do this on weekends as well, I'm not completely there as far as like not doing any work on the weekends, lol, but we'll talk more about that. So for every work day, what you do is you, when you're kind of planning what you do for the day or whatever, you might do this in the morning or maybe the night before, is you write down your tasks with this 3-3-3 method. So you use 3 hours of the day to work on your most important project. So maybe you're working on an article, or maybe you're writing a piece of music, something that takes you multiple, you know, days, weeks, months to get done. So you have to work on it on a consistent basis. So decide 3 hours a day to work on that thing. And then however you kind of divide that time, that 3 hours that you set aside, you might use the Pomodoro method or whatever, work on a timer, whatever works for you for that 3 hours. Then the second three is for three work-related tasks. Something that's less time-consuming. So like each of these three things you should be able to get done in like less than an hour. So it might be like working on emails for like an hour, or a meeting. Meetings also count. So like a Zoom meeting, write that down as one of your three because that's labor. Maybe it's a reading that you have to do, or maybe it's lesson planning or something like that. Just like a shorter work task, like pick a maximum of three. Then the last three is maintenance tasks. So I've kind of interpreted this. I don't know if this is actually the original meaning. I think this is the Lydia interpretation of it. A maintenance task for me is like a home-related thing or a self-maintenance-related thing, like a self-care-related thing, because that is also labor. And so for me, in that category, I always put like cooking or meal prep counts as one of those things. Cleaning counts as one of those things. Doing an errand counts as one of those things. Any sort of self-care-related thing, like exercise counts as one of those things. So you have kind of your big three, like your main tasks that you're going to spend 3 hours on that day. You have three smaller things, work-related things that you just need, you know, 30, 40 minutes, an hour to like set that aside and get done. And then three things related to your own personal maintenance and care. So the maintenance of your home or doing an errand or something like that. Again, I count like exercise, I count skincare, any sort of like extra, you know, thing that you do to maintain yourself. This method is really, really helpful for me because it helps me to clearly see the different types of labor that I do in a day, and it helps me to recognize different types of labor. Oftentimes, I can feel really bad about a day of work if I like don't get this huge paper done in like one day, or I don't get this huge task done, or like, you know, the school related stuff doesn't go very well. But then I can look at my 3-3-3 and be like, well, I actually did all of these things and all of that counts as labor. Maintaining your home is labor. Cooking and cleaning is labor. Exercise, that's labor on behalf of yourself and your body. Running errands is labor. Organizing your space or organizing your calendar is labor. And writing emails is labor. Like learning to recognize all of those things as different types of labor, but also labor that you should take into account when you are deciding how productive a day has been for you. And again, not every day has to be productive. So you don't have to use this every day. You don't have to use this every work day. But if this method is helpful for you in terms of, again, for me, it just reframes like when I've had a really bad writing day and I only wrote one page and it feels really frustrating and it feels like, oh, I've wasted this day. But like I meal prepped and I went outside and did all of my errands and I lesson planned for the next day and then I answered emails. That's actually a pretty productive day. Maybe not in the way that I was hoping or in a way that I prioritize as far as like, again, what counts as labor. I want to make sure that we are counting all the unseen stuff too, right? All the household stuff, quote unquote, women's work. We need to recognize that as labor when we do it or when our roommates or partners do it. And again, self-maintenance is labor. It's work to take care of yourself and your body. It's work to cook for yourself and to plan meals. It's work to maintain like whatever sort of hygiene rituals that you have. And it's work to find time to move your body and to actually do it. Recognize that stuff for what it is, that it takes hard work and it takes intention and preparation and dedication. Reward yourself for that labor. So yeah, using that 333 method has been really helpful for me. If parts of that are helpful for you, I hope that you give it a try. And again, don't be afraid to kind of adjust for you if it's a 323 method, right? Like adjust the numbers or adjust kind of those definitions around the type of labor that you do, both professional and in your personal life, and see what works for you. Don't be afraid to change it up. Don't be afraid to experiment. So yeah, overall, with the added emphasis on simplicity and on simplifying routines and prioritizing not saying yes to everything, really saying no a lot more, has led to a better semester. Now, certainly there are still stressful moments. That comps exam. Certainly stressful moments. Obviously, finals are always stressful. You know, all the stuff with the strike has been stressful. So, you know, it's you're never going to have like an easy, breezy, beautiful cover girl semester with no challenges, because part of grad school is that it's challenging. It's supposed to challenge you. It's supposed to grow you. So it wasn't perfect, obviously, and I haven't navigated everything perfectly, obviously, but much improved from last semester, I think, by setting the intention of going into the year with, I'm going to say no almost as much as possible, right? Like I'm really going to think about, if I say yes to something, is it going to make my life easier or is it going to make my life more complicated? And if it is going to make my life more complicated, is it worth the complications, right, that it's going to bring? Because it might be worth it, but really going into your semester or your next season with that in mind about like, okay, I'm going to prioritize things being as simple as possible, which means I really have to think through every opportunity that comes into my inbox or every time that someone asks me if I'd be interested in something, if I want to do them a favor, if I want to like really expand, like examining my own bandwidth about what I can handle, and is saying yes to that going to impede upon my ability to go to sleep on time or to, you know, do my meal prep or to, you know, like, what is it gonna infringe upon? And it might be worth it. Again, some things are like worth sacrificing for. You just have to think about it critically. And I think last semester, I wasn't thinking critically. I was saying yes to everything. And I didn't have a good conceptualization of what boundaries look like in the academic space. That's really hard to develop. So I want to develop it now. I really want to think through that now and continue to think about that going forward. So here are some kind of loose goals that I've been thinking about also for the summer of 2023. Again, we're prioritizing simplicity. We're getting serious about rest. I actually want this to be a restful summer. Last summer, I was doing a lot. Here's what I was doing. I wasn't doing a lot professionally, I was doing a lot socially, which, like, cute. We love a social butterfly summer. I feel like this has to be Lydia's, like, sleep summer, right? Like, because we are going to do some traveling, and that's all well and good. I have prepared for that mentally, emotionally, spiritually. So I think we're going to have a good time traveling. I'm excited to do kind of, I'll probably do maybe a review episode of like the summer and tell you how some traveling things went. We're still going to be pursuing a few professional opportunity things. So we'll get to that. But I really want to get serious about rest this summer, because it's so easy for the summer to slip away from you, and for especially in academia, you're supposed to catch up on all your stuff. You're supposed to be like writing your articles and all that stuff. Like, there's so much to catch up on in addition to traveling, getting in all the traveling that you can't do during the year. Again, I think it's just going to take an intention on my part going into the summer, as far as like, again, some stress is unavoidable, some travel is unavoidable, some professional stuff is unavoidable. It's not like we're not going to do any work, but I do want to set the intention this summer of like, let's still pursue rest as much as we can, as much as I have access to. When can I choose rest instead of choosing another opportunity, an extra thing, like another, you know, like, do I have to say yes to every new opportunity, even if it's the summer? And even if you have the time to work on it, you might have the time, but still evaluate, even though I have the time to do this, would the rest be more valuable to me? Would the downtime be more valuable to me than that opportunity to go on that trip or that opportunity to pursue that new academic thing? I'm trying to think critically, people. I need you to hold me accountable. I'm thinking about it in advance, and I'm setting an intention so that we do not repeat past social butterfly Lydia's mistakes. I'd like to be asleep during the summer, okay? So I'm really thinking about that. One of the practical things, again, I want to create like a practical goal to really think about in order to turn this kind of larger woo-woo goal into, you know, actually, you know, actualize something. So something I've been thinking a lot about is transitioning to a 4-day work week. I think that I'll be able to take my Fridays off going into next school year with the way that my schedule is set up. And so I'd like to take the summer to kind of prepare and transition to 4-day work weeks. We're going to do a Monday through Thursday experimentation this summer, see how that works. And then that might work for me in the fall. So that's like a really practical thing where I'm like, I want to chop a whole day of the work week and really prioritize doing that. Another thing, I want to chop my work day during the summer. Now, this will definitely revert in the fall. But during the summer, if I really want to be serious about rest, not only am I doing a 4-day work week, I'm doing a 4-hour work day. So we are a part-time girly during the summer, okay? I think that that's going to work really well for me. I'm definitely a morning person. I'm most productive in the morning. So I'm going to experiment with doing academic work that, again, anything related to reading for school, writing for school, podcast stuff. All of that is going to be confined to the morning. And then we're going to chop it after lunch. And then I'm going to enjoy the sun. I'm going to do a lot of roller skating, running, seeing my friends, being asleep, taking naps, reading fiction, enjoying my evenings. So I think I'm going to be kind of experimenting with that. It does feel drastic to me, and I do imagine myself kind of, it's going to take me a while to actually honor that. But again, I think even setting the intention, even if I don't hit it every day, even if I end up working into the afternoon or into the evening, that is something that I really want to prioritize. And even setting the intention and making it public, LOL, is going to help me with achieving that goal. It doesn't have to be every day for it to be something that really, really benefits me. And I think that I'm going to see the benefits of that. So again, I encourage you to think about, obviously, whatever your work schedule is during the summer, you don't have to set it up like me at all. I'm by far like not the model. And again, I'm absolutely not going to do this perfectly. I know that right off the bat. But if I can encourage you to, before the summer begins, really think about setting an intention for the summer, set a summer theme, right? Like, what do you want your summer to look like? How do you want to feel during the summer? Do you want to be like booked and busy and having like a really social time? That's great. Again, social butterfly Lydia last summer, she had a time. It was fun. I don't regret it, but I do recognize that that's not the way that I want to feel this summer. because by the time that I got to the fall and the fall semester started, I felt my social battery tapped out a lot faster because I hadn't really prioritized a lot of alone time and a lot of rest last summer. So, like, I hesitate to say I regret it, but that summer was that summer, and I recognize that I want to feel different this summer. So this is just an ask, like, how do you want to feel this summer? How do you want to feel at the end of the summer going into your school year, into your next semester? Like, think about it. Take a moment to, like, write down a few adjectives. I want to feel rested. I want to feel prepared. I want to feel excited, or I want to, like, brainstorm how you want to feel, and then think backwards. What do I have to do this summer in order to arrive in August feeling like XYZ? So reverse engineer it. Really take some time to think about it. When you're driving or when you're cooking, when you have an alone moment, just think about how you want to feel and then the types of actions that you have to take in order to pursue your ideal outcome, how you want to show up for the school year in August. All right, last thing, let's wrap this up. These episodes are getting so long. I hope y'all are still rocking with me, and I hope that it's valuable to you in some way. But I just wanted to end with kind of a little update on Hermes Academia and what's happening and the future of the podcast. So this semester was hugely successful for the podcast. I'm really excited and I'm really proud of the episodes that we were able to put out. I did a lot for Black History Month. That was a lot. 5 episodes is a lot. But I'm really, really glad that we could put those together. I was glad to introduce some episodes for Women's History Month. So that felt like a huge success and something that I would love to do next year. So I'm already thinking about how Black History Month and Women's History Month can look next year. Something that I want to share, some huge, huge news that has happened for the show is that I really decided to devote a lot of time to Hermes Academia this semester. And one of those things that I wanted to devote time to was specifically writing grants for the podcast. It's a research podcast, so I was pursuing a lot of research grants. I wanted to start to get the podcast funded. You know, I haven't made money from this podcast, and I've been doing it for 2 years now. So, and that's because I enjoy it, right? Like, I genuinely enjoy the conversations. I enjoy the community that's developed because of it. I enjoy the connections that I've made because of it. I am so happy whenever someone emails me to tell me how much they like the show or to ask to be on the show. Like, several episodes, probably at least like 10 episodes, have happened because someone has emailed me and been like, I want to be on the show. So if you still have yet to do that because you're like, oh, well, Lydia would never want me on it, send me an email, please. Don't overthink it. That's really exciting to me to see, like, my world and my connections, my academic network and my friendships, like, develop in real time because of this show. And I knew that this semester was, like, the semester to really go for it and invest in it. So I spent a ton of time writing a bunch of grant proposals and saying, I have this music research podcast and I'm really trying to get some stuff funded. I want to maybe do an archival trip. Like, I have all these ideas for where I want the podcast to go, but I'm going to need some money to do it. So I decided to really spend some time pursuing those avenues this semester. And I'm really proud to report that I've been granted 3 grants. So one of them is through the Excel Lab at the University of Michigan, specifically in the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. So the Excel Lab is this really, really cool home base for all things like music entrepreneurship at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance. The Excel Lab, Excel stands for Excellence in Entrepreneurship, Career Empowerment, and Leadership. So it's just this really cool space in which it's people's dedicated jobs to help performers and educators and whatever you do in the performing arts, like to help you actually make a career out of that and kind of make your own career, forge your own path related to the performing arts. So every year they give out a bunch of different grants ranging from like $1,000 to like $5,000. And then they give this big $10,000 grant every year. And so I decided to apply for both a smaller $1,000 grant for a specific project that's coming later. And I decided to apply for the $10,000. And I won. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I am looking at my giant check. They paid, you know, they printed one of those giant checks with your name on it and $10,000 on it. It's above my desk, and I'm looking in the eyes of my giant check, and I won $10,000 for the podcast. Not me about to cry on this podcast right now. I'm still in shock at this point. It was like 2 weeks ago that the announcement was made, and I got to go to the ceremony and accept my big check. And like, yeah, I specifically applied for the money because I've been really thinking a lot about the future of the podcast and what is going to be sustainable. And, you know, we're still at the point where like I do this whole podcast by myself, and I do not get paid to do this podcast. This is a labor of love for you, the listener. So I still, you know, I obviously host the podcast. I do all the research related to the podcast. I manage all the guests and the scheduling. I do all of the editing for the podcast. I manage the RSS feed. I manage the website. I post the podcast, like all that stuff. I write the show notes. Like I do everything for this podcast by myself. And I'm still a student. And I have to pass my classes. So, you know, this is something that I love doing. And I do not have any intentions of stopping the podcast because I love doing it. But we have gotten to the point where, you know, I've hit the wall in terms of productivity as far as like how much of the podcast I'm actually able to produce by myself. I can only go so fast as a one-woman show, right? Like I can only edit as fast as I can edit, which again, I'm not an audio engineer. I'm not a professional. The listeners know that this podcast started off in a raggedy place and continues to, you know, slowly get better. But I'm not an audio engineer. I need professional help. So in order to up the quality of the podcast, as well as how much I'm able to actually produce the podcast and how long I'm able to do the podcast before, right, I just get burnt out from doing it all myself, I really, really wanted to prioritize getting a Her Music Academia team together. It's a huge priority for me to hire an editor. It's a huge priority for me to, for accessibility reasons, I'd really like the podcast to be transcribed. It needs to be written down. I want it to be readable for people who are hearing impaired or for whatever reason would prefer to read the podcast rather than listen to the podcast. And then I also do zero marketing for the show because I just don't have the time. I do not run like a social media account. Y'all know I have a private Instagram. You cannot follow me on Instagram. So, you know, there's no public presence for the podcast. We're not on TikTok. We're not on Instagram. We're not on Twitter. And so that was also something that I was thinking about as far as like, how do we begin to advertise the podcast in like on the social media landscape, which is especially important for something like a podcast. So I applied for this money and made an argument, and then I won. Tears, I'm about to start crying. I cannot articulate what this means to me. I've just been doing it for so long, and I really, really enjoy doing it. You know, we've now passed into after my second year of podcasting into my third year. And it's something from the beginning that I've really loved doing, that I knew that there would be large implications for my career, which is why I started it, right? Like I knew coming into music theory that there was a huge lack of the perspective of Black women in classical music, in music academia, that, like, I just was, I, that our voice is missing from these spaces. And I knew that I wanted to do something about that. And I'm really glad that I decided to take the leap and just put my thoughts out there. And now it's like paying off. It's like, is this show a big deal? Like, maybe. We're actually, oh, this is exciting. We're actually about to hit 10,000 listens. Listener, this is so exciting. 10,000. So this actually might be the episode that pushes over 10,000 listens, which is so, I just want to thank you. I cannot articulate what this means to me. Your support and your feedback, and if you're listening to this and you've ever shared the show, or you've sent me an email to tell me that you enjoy the show, or you've been a guest on the show, in whatever capacity that you have interacted with me and been a part of this community, this is so major. It's so huge. And your support means the world to me. As someone who was really doubting when I was entering the space that, like, that I was going to be able to persevere and make it through a space that is so historically hostile to me. So your support, like, I cannot articulate enough. It's getting me through this program. And I'm just so excited to continue making the podcast and making content for you and engaging with you. Okay. I'm okay. Just thank you. Just thank you. Really. Like, for listening and for interacting and for recommending the show. And really, thank you. So yes. I have a ton of plans for the future of Her Music Academia and the blog and how that's going to be incorporated. So there's a lot of interesting things that I'm spinning into motion. I am starting the process of putting together a team, which is so exciting. You know, somebody has to snatch together my raggedy editing. I'm so excited to have some professionals join me in this endeavor. And I'm really, really excited to actually be able to pay people well for their time as far as coming onto the team to help me. Like, I'm gonna have a team. Oh my God. So it's all really, really exciting. I should also mention that I got a $5,000 grant from the National Center of Institutional Diversity here at the University of Michigan. So this was specifically grants that you can apply for an anti-racist project. And the podcast got a grant. I am floored, and I'm so happy and honored that everything transpired this way. And looking back retroactively at me in January, February, and March, like, slaving away at these grants and like, oh God, is the podcast even a real thing? Is it real research? Are people even listening? Like, I don't know what the point is. And it's just been really transformational. So big things coming on the show. I'm so excited for you to hear everything that we've got cooking up. Again, okay, y'all know I don't really do a lot of, like, make sure you like, comment, and subscribe, like, on the, because I have a very loyal listenership. From the numbers, the majority of you listen, like, the day this comes out or the day after it comes out. So thank you for your consistency in listening. You know, this is going to be my one time being like, okay, it's go time. This is a group effort, everyone. So now that we've come into some monetary success, and now that this is going to become an even more professional opportunity and endeavor for me, I would really appreciate if you continue to share the podcast, if you leave a rating, if you leave a review. That stuff actually really, really helps, like, algorithm-wise, that people have good things to say about the show. So if you've never left a review before, or tapped the little stars on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify to rate the podcast, that would actually be supremely helpful for me. So if you could just take a few moments, pull over the car, don't crash your car, when you get a moment to leave a review and to tell me what you like about the show, tell me what you don't like about the show, please send me an email, hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Please tell me, like, what you like about the show, what you want to see on the show. It, like, your comments always really make my day and help me continue the forward momentum. So I would really love to hear from you. And again, if you are listening to this and you're thinking, oh man, it would be so cool to be on HMA, but like Lydia would never have, listen, it is do or die time. Okay. If there's ever been a moment to email me about the podcast and to tell me that you want to be on the show, this is your moment. I cannot stress this enough. I cannot. We are in do or die time. It's about to kind of launch into being something. So I would love to talk to you about what you do in music. So please send me an email, hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Tell me a bit about what you do and let's see if we can get you or your work, your ideas, your suggestions on the show. I'm really thankful that this is like a community show that develops out of your feedback, like directly, and develops from people saying, I'd like to be on the show, and then they come on the show. So like, it's really important. I want you to be involved. So please, this is the time. Send me an email. So that is going to do it for this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Y'all, like, we made it. Like, am I a star? This is crazy. Thank you so much for listening. Again, your support means the absolute world to me and makes all the difference in my own personal success as a musician and as an academic. These episodes are getting so long. I'm so sorry. But I hope that it was valuable to you in some way. I hope that taking the time to reflect on my progress in this program, my progress this semester, everything that I'm learning, can help you also to reflect on the ways in which you have grown in 2023. As I mentioned earlier, if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, and you want to send them to me, you can email me at hermusicacademia@gmail.com. If you want to be on the show, if you have suggestions for what I should talk about or read or listen to, please send them there. Or you can go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, fill out the contact form there. Please get in touch with me. I'm so excited to hear from you. Always, always. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership. Thank you for sharing the podcast. Thank you for being a part of this community. There's so much to come, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Until next time, thanks for listening.